Florence and Mabel and Dulcie. I'll just have to coach Dad. Alan knows how to bump our site up on search engines too. He's been rather a star. My brochures are all printed. The final versions arrived yesterday and they're perfect. The paper is just rustic enough, the font is evocative, the pictures are amazing. The whole thing works. I'm so proud of it. Not only of the farm, but of the brochure. I'm proud of my work. And as I sit here, at my desk, proofreading some endless report on the new brand architecture of Associated Soap, what I keep thinking is, could I get my brochure to Demeter? Could I get her to look at it properly? Really see it? If I leave a brochure on her desk, she won't look at it. If I give it to her at the wrong moment, she won't look at it. Alex's voice keeps running through my head, which makes me cringe, but I have to admit his advice was good. Pitch her exactly the right idea, exactly when she needs it. After all, he knows how Demeter works. Actually, that's a thought I could do without. Move on. I need to make it count, because I think if she truly focuses on it, she'll love it. I've learned so much from Demeter. I finished that book of hers, Our Vision, and at the back I found some old sketches she'd done. Just studying those taught me something. At my most positive, optimistic moments, I even think, could I become her protégé? If she sees my work and likes it, might she give me a chance? All I have to do is find a moment when she's available and receptive. But that won't be easy. Demeter has never been less receptive or available. In fact, to be honest, the atmosphere at work has never been weirder. A lot's gone wrong since Christmas. No one's happy. Everyone's tense. And even I, the lowliest of the low, am aware that Demeter's at the eye of the storm. Flora gets the inside track from Rosa, and she's told me all about it. First of all, there was the email. It was sent by Demeter, by mistake, and it insulted one of our clients. He's head of marketing at the Forest Food restaurant chain, and apparently, after some stormy meeting, Demeter called him suburban, with no handle on style, in a draft email to Rosa, and then sent it to him by mistake. Ouch. So that was a whole big incident, and Demeter walked around for a while with a pale, panicky face. Then, last week, things got worse. Rosa's been working with Mark and some others on a new brief for Sensequo, one of our beauty clients. And it's been a shambles, with deadlines coming and being missed. Apparently, it's not their fault. Demeter's been sitting on everything they send to her and not getting back to them. The final straw came last week, when Demeter finally set up a meeting with Sensequo, then had to cancel it. Apparently, she didn't seem to know what stage the project was at, and it was quite embarrassing. So the Sensequo people got furious and complained to Adrian. As a result, Demeter's in a real state. She keeps coming into the room, stopping dead and looking at us all as though she doesn't know who we are. And the other day, I came across her and Rosa having a furious row in the ladies. Demeter was talking in a low, frenzied voice, saying, "I should have checked. Rosa, I don't hold this against you. I should have checked the facts for myself. I'm your boss. It's my responsibility." Whereupon Rosa looked at her with something close to hatred and said evenly, "You knew we weren't ready, Demeter. I told you." "No, no," Demeter shook her head. "You told me you were ready." "No, I didn't," Rosa practically screamed, and I hastily backed out of the ladies altogether. At times like this, you basically want to be invisible. So that's what I'm trying to be. Invisible. Today, though, everything's pretty quiet, and I wonder if the worst has blown over. I'm just getting up from my desk to make a coffee, when Flora comes bounding up.
"Hey," she says. "So, are you on for a drink at lunchtime? We're starting our Wednesday meetings up again."
"Oh, right." My spirits whoosh straight up. "Great! Yes!" I've been wondering what happened to the Wednesday thing. Only I haven't wanted to ask. To be honest, immediately after the Christmas party, I was pretty furious with Flora, but my anger gradually blew over. She was drunk. We all get drunk and say stupid things, and she doesn't even remember it, so at least I can pretend it never happened.
"Everything's been so crazy, we haven't been able to do it. But we're all determined. We need to crack on. She sits on my desk and starts plaiting her hair. God, this place! It's insane! Everyone's imploding! So, what's the latest? I lower my voice. I know Flora loves relaying gossip to me, and the truth is, I love hearing it. Well, she leans closer. Apparently Demeter's going to talk to Sensequo, like, try to win them back, because they're worth a lot. And if we lose forest food too, Flora pulls a face. So is the company in trouble? I feel tendrils of alarm. Demeter's in trouble, vile cow. Except Alex will stand up for her, so... Flora shrugs. If you're shagging one of the partners, you're never in that much trouble, right? My insides squirm at the image of Demeter shagging Alex. I don't want to think about it. Anyway, see you later, says Flora. Shall we go along together? Great, I beam back. See you then. I'm feeling more positive than I have for ages as I head to the kitchen. I'm looking forward to this lunchtime drink so much, it's actually quite uncool. But I'm starved of fun. It'll be so great to kick back, have a drink, and maybe talk about stuff other than how the company's imploding and Demeter's a monster. To my surprise, I can hear Adrian's voice as I get near the kitchen. It's unusual for him to be on our floor, and I suddenly stop dead with a new thought. Shall I give my Anstis Farm brochure to Adrian? I barely know him. He's quite a remote figure, but his smile is always kind. He looks like the sort of guy who might give a junior a chance. I dash back to my desk, grab the brochure, and approach the kitchen again. I feel a bit keyed up, but I'm determined that I won't be coy. I'll just tell him. I want to be noticed, and this is my calling card. It's only as I'm halfway through the door that I actually hear what he's saying. He's speaking in a low voice, his brows knitted.
Can't understand what's going on, and frankly, nor can I. Alex, you told me Demeter was the real deal.
Oh, God, it's just Adrian and Alex having some high-level powwow, and I've stumbled in. Should I back out again?
She is the real deal, Alex retorts. At least, Jesus, he thrusts his hands through his hair. I'll talk to her. You'd better.
Alex draws breath, then notices me standing there, frozen.
Oh,
he gives Adrian a warning look, and Adrian turns too. Sorry, I stutter. I didn't mean to...
No, no.
Adrian's urbane bonhomie is back.
Go ahead. I'll talk to you later.
He shoots a meaningful look at Alex and strides out. So now it's just Alex and me, alone together, which is pretty much exactly what I was hoping would never happen again. Trying to ignore him, I head over to the Nespresso machine, shove a pod in, and turn it on. Alex seems a bit lost for words, which is unlike him.
So, he says after a lengthy pause. Hi. Did you have a good Christmas? Pacini stuffing, wasn't it?
And I know I'm uber prickly at the moment, but even the way he says Pacini stuffing seems patronizing. I can sense the pity seeping out of him, through his words, through his sympathetic expression. My entire body is seething. I don't want his pity. I don't want him to let me down lightly. What's he thinking right now? Poor tragic girl, got a crush on the boss, must be kind to her. Well, fuck off. And I know that's not reasonable. It was great, thanks, I say stiffly. Yours?
Yes, good, he nods, surveying me with those quick, clever eyes, then takes a deep breath as though he wants to say something awkward.
Immediately, alarm bells ring all over my body. I'm not doing that. I'm not standing here, listening to him dole out platitudes, while my cheeks burn and my mouth goes to sawdust. So, I say shrilly. Actually, I'm not in the mood for coffee after all.
Cat,
see you later. I walk briskly out of the kitchen like someone who has a super brilliant life with lots to get done. As I reach the corridor, a lift is waiting with its doors open, and without thinking, I get in. The doors close and I utter a tiny scream, my hands clamped over my face, still holding the Anstis Farm brochure. But then, within 10 seconds, I'm pulling myself together. I'm not going to lose it. Not over a man. It's fine, I tell myself sternly. Everyone has the odd embarrassing moment in their life, and I just need to get this in perspective. What I'll do is, I'll go up to the top and then back down again, and that will give me some breathing space. The lift travels up to the top floor, where Demeter gets in.
I find myself eyeing her curiously. She really looks in a state. Her makeup isn't quite as immaculate as usual for a start. Her eyes are distant, and she keeps muttering something to herself. She doesn't even seem to notice me as she jabs the button for our floor. And I know this isn't the best time, but something's coming over me, a need to be something. I'm still smarting from Alex's pity. So, he's sleeping with Demeter. So what? It doesn't mean I'm a tragic nothing. Standing there, watching Demeter scrolling agitatedly through her phone, I have this desperate, overwhelming urge to prove myself. Demeter, I rouse her from her reverie. Can I give you this? I hold the brochure out and she takes it automatically. Kath, she peers at me as if she's only just realized there's another person in the lift. Yes? So, let me explain what this is. Kath, Demeter wrinkles her brow as though the sight of me is throwing her into fresh disarray. Kath, she scrolls back and forth on her phone, even more dementedly, frowning at her screen as though it's in ancient Greek. I did talk to you. We did talk? She really seems quite crazy. Flora says the truth is, she's not up to running a department, and to look at her now, I'd have to agree. I mean, what's she on about? Is she worried about not communicating with the junior staff? I nod reassuringly. We've talked loads. Then I gesture at the brochure, trying to get her to focus on it. So, this is a project I've, well, masterminded, I suppose. Demeter's gaze sweeps over the brochure, but I'm not sure she sees it. Because, Kath, what I want to say to you is, her eyes zoom in on my face as though finally she's found her topic. What I really want to say to you. To my shock, she stops the lift, then turns to face me. Demeter, I say uncertainly. Kath, I know it's difficult for you to hear this, she says in those firm, strident tones of hers, but it will turn out all for the good. In fact, this could be the best thing that ever happened to you. She nods emphatically. The best thing. Okay. She really has lost it. I don't know what she's on about. The best thing, I echo. I don't quite... You just have to stay positive, okay? She gives me an encouraging smile. You're so talented and bright. I know you'll do well in life. I know you'll get there. There's an angle to this speech that is making me feel not worried exactly, but worried. It's almost as if... Get where, I say more desperately than I meant to. Positive about what? What are you talking about? There's a long, still silence in the lift. Demeter looks at me. She looks at her phone. The wild, starry look has come back to her eyes a hundredfold. Fuck, she says almost in a whisper. I have no idea how to respond to this, but there's a new sensation creeping over me. It's grey and clammy. It's foreboding. We haven't spoken. Demeter knocks a fist to her head. I didn't think we had, but... She peers at her phone and her eyes dim. I'm going insane. Spoken about? I can't finish the sentence. The words feel like glass marbles, crowding my throat, making me choke. For 30 seconds, there's silence in the lift. I feel almost light-headed. This can't be happening. This isn't happening. Then, as though breaking the spell, Demeter thumps the lift button and we start to travel again. We need a meeting, Kath, she says in the briskest of businesslike tones. Why not come to my office straight away? A meeting about what? I force myself to say the words, but Demeter doesn't answer. Just come along, she says, sweeping out of the lift, and I follow. I think there must be a script to these things. And Demeter follows it to the letter. Difficult times, current financial challenges, department contracting, budget constraints. Been such a wonderful addition. So deeply and personally sorry. Wonderful reference. Anything we can do. And I sit and listen, with my hands clamped so tightly in my lap, they ache. My face is immobile, my demeanor is calm. But all the time my brain is crying out like a child. There is something you can do. You can let me keep my job. You can let me keep my job. Please let me keep my job. It's all I want. Please,
please, please. I can't have no job. I can't.
No job. The thought is so frightening, so engulfing, it feels like a real physical threat, like a 100-foot tsunami looming out of nowhere, paralyzing me with its enormity. I can't run or escape or beg. It's too late. It's upon me. I know there are difficult times and current financial challenges. I do read the news, and maybe I should have seen this coming, but I didn't. I didn't. Demeter is now on to the generic stuff. Looking forward, any help we can give you, proper paperwork. She started glancing at her screen as she talks. She's mentally moved on. Job done. Tick. I feel as though I'm in a dream, as she suggests I might like to work out my week's notice, or I might like to take money in lieu. Money, I manage to utter. I need the money. There's no point sticking around. If I leave now, I can start making applications to other places. Fine, says Demeter. I'll just call talent management. She makes a quick call that I barely hear. My thoughts are such a whirl of terror. Then she turns back. In fact, Megan in talent management needs to see you, so she suggested you pop up straight away. Shall I walk you to the lift? And then I stood up, and I'm following her down the hall. And still, I feel like I'm in a dream. I'm disembodied. This can't be reality. It can't. But then we arrive at the lift and something slices through my dream state, a sharp resentment. I've been so good up to now, such a model employee being fired and not making a fuss, that it's as if something in me breaks free in protest. So, in the lift, you thought you'd already fired me, I say bluntly. I can see I've hit home, from the flinch that passes across Demeter's face. I apologize if there was any misunderstanding, she says, and her weasel words make me want to slap her. If. If. Of course there was a misunderstanding. My voice is tart, even to my own ears. Kath, no, I get it. It's such a trivial, unimportant detail to you. You couldn't remember if you'd done it or not. I mean, I understand. I throw up my hands. You have a very full, exciting diary. Meetings, lunches, parties, fire your employee. No wonder you can't keep track. I didn't know I could sound quite so sarcastic, but if I thought I was going to make Demeter chastened, I was wrong. Kath, she says calmly, I appreciate this is an upsetting time for you, but it's a mistake to become bitter. If we stay on good terms, keep the door open, who knows? Perhaps you'll come back and work for us again. Have you read Grasp the Nettle by Marilyn D. Schulenberg? It's a very inspiring book for all working women. It's just been published. I read a proof copy some time ago. Of course she read a proof copy. Demeter would never wait for a book to be actually available in the shops, like normal people. No, I say evenly. I haven't read it. Well, there we are. Demeter looks pleased with herself. Here's a goal for you. When you leave here, go straight to Waterstones and buy it. You'll find it inspiring. Listen to this quote. She scrolls through her phone, then reads aloud. Take your future into your own hands. Make it happen. Life is a colouring book, but you have the pens. I'm trying to stay polite, but my distress is seething up. Doesn't she understand anything about anything? I can't afford to buy a hardback book telling me to colour in my life. I try not to be envious. I really, really try. But right now, all I want to do is yell. It's all right for you. Your life is already coloured in, and you didn't even go over the edges. The voice in my head is so loud, I feel like she must be able to hear it. But Demeter's still looking at me with that complacent expression. She'll probably boast later about how she gave me lots of marvellous advice, and I was really grateful. And then, just to cap off a perfect day, I spot Alex. He's walking along the corridor toward us with a questioning look. He glances at Demeter, and she makes a quick answering face, and my humiliation is complete. So, I say stiffly to him, I'm off. Thanks for the job and everything. I thought you knew. I can hear the wince in Alex's voice. Earlier on, I'm sorry. I'm aware of Alex and Demeter exchanging expressions in a kind of shorthand. They have a body language I never picked up on before, a kind of easy, close naturalness that you don't get with a professional colleague. I wonder if they shag here at work. Well, of course they do. Demeter's phone buzzes, and she answers it. Hello? Oh, Michael. Yes, I did get your email. She lifts up five fingers at me, which I guess means wait 5 minutes, and steps into a nearby empty room, and I'm left with Alex. Again. I glance up at him and see his kind, tactful eyes, and I can't bear it. I can't bear it. The horror of my job loss is so devastating, you'd think nothing else would even sting. You'd think I'd be numb to lesser feelings like humiliation and crushed pride. But I'm not. They're just smart in a different way. And suddenly, I don't want to keep quiet anymore. Why do we all do that? Why do we all pretend? I know what the rules say. Salvage your dignity, walk away, admit nothing. But I'm never going to see this man again in my life. And suddenly the desire to say what I really think is bigger than any other. You know what? I say abruptly. Let's address what happened at the Christmas party. What? Alice looks so gobsmacked at the idea I nearly want to laugh. Flora said I was in love with you, I press on. Well, of course I'm not. That's ridiculous. Look, Alex seems to be seeking escape. We really don't have to do this. All I thought was that you and I had, I search for the best way to put it, a spark, a tiny little spark of, I don't know, connection, possibility. I like spending time with you. At the time, I didn't know anything about you, and I break off. I'm not going to say Demeter out loud in a company corridor. He'll know what I mean. So, I'm embarrassed now, I resume. Really embarrassed. Of course I am. But you know something? I'm owning my embarrassment. I'm not hiding or playing games. I lift my chin, high and resolute. Here I am, Katie Brenner, embarrassed. There are worse things to be. The wrong name has slipped out, I realise, but I don't care. Alex looks stupefied by my little speech. Well, good. I feel liberated and even kind of exhilarated. So my cheeks are blazing, so my legs are a bit wobbly. So bloody what? Okay then, I add. So that was all I had to say, except goodbye. Tell Demeter I've gone up. Good luck with everything. I jab the lift button and stare fixedly at it, waiting. Cat, Alex begins, then stops. Katie, he tries again, but he doesn't seem to know where he wants to go next. And despite the fact that everything about my situation is horrendous, and will seem even more horrendous when I get home, I feel a tiny twinge of satisfaction. At least that patronizing expression has disappeared from his face. Cat, Alex tries a third time. What are you going to do now? Now? I mean, job-wise. Now I've spoken to Kath, Demeter comes swooping back into the conversation from nowhere. I've told her to stay positive. She's going to buy Grasp the Nettle and take her inspiration from that. Oh, great, says Alex weakly. Good idea. I thought so, Demeter nods, and they both look at me as though, phew, we recommended a book. Our consciences can be clear now. They have no idea, either of them. Educated people talk about ignorance. Well, how ignorant are these two? Do they know what it's like to live in Catford on a tiny, scraping, heart-juddering budget? I'm not going to buy that book, Demeter, I say in a voice which suddenly trembles, because it'll be £18, and I can't afford it. I can't afford anything. Don't you understand? I'm not like you. I'm not like you. Demeter is peering at me with a blank frown. Really, Kath? I think if you can afford to eat at Salt Block, you can afford to buy a very inspiring book. I can't afford to eat at Salt Block. How do you think I could ever afford to do that? That was all bullshit. I was trying to impress you. My anguish spills out in a scream. I don't have a financial cushion or a famous daddy to give me a career. A dart of shock passes across Alex's face, but I don't care. It's true. You're so fucking entitled. Both of you. I spread my arms wide, encompassing Alex. Do you know that? Do you have any idea? Any sense of... I break off and give a little odd-sounding laugh.
Of course you don't. Okay, well, I'm leaving now, so enjoy your perfect lives.
The lift doors have opened and I step inside. I jab the button for the third floor and begin to rise, thankfully without either of them trying to follow me. My eyes are stinging and my heart is miserably pounding. So much for a dignified exit. So much for keeping the door open. But right now, I really don't care.
Chapter 11. It's funny how life works like a seesaw. Some things go up while others plunge down. My life is swiftly unraveling while Dad's is finally, it seems, coming together. He sent me pictures of the constructed yurts, and they look wonderful. The bathroom block is gleaming, the fire pits look picturesque, the bunting is charming, and Biddy has stockpiled homemade jam. Meanwhile, we sent out the brochures to everyone we can think of. Dad has left piles of them in every trendy cafe around Somerset, while I've targeted likely places in London. I left a pile in a cafe in Wandsworth, and a woman in a Bowden mag picked one up while I was still there. It was like magic. But that's not the half of it. That's not even the 10% of it. What's happened to Dad and Biddy this week is like a lottery win, like a freak pot of gold under the rainbow. I still can't quite believe it's happened. The Guardian has profiled Anstey's Farm Country Retreat in its glamping roundup. It's nuts! I mean, Anstey's Farm isn't even a thing yet. But clearly some journalist was under a deadline and found the website and thought, this'll do. It's all in the piece, the yurts, the chickens, even my prose about children being children. They printed a photo of a campfire in front of a yurt and captioned it, Anstey's Farm is the latest family haven for hip glampers. And I nearly died when I saw it. I mean, The Guardian! And if I'd still been at work, it would have been my greatest ever triumph. I could have marched into Demeter's office and said, there's branding for you. But I'm not. It's the last week of February and I don't have a job. I don't have the prospect of a job. I just have aching hands from typing job applications, Googling brand agencies, and writing spec letters. I've written an individual email for each application. I've researched every single possible company in the UK that I might suit. My mind is reeling with product names, campaigns, contacts. I'm exhausted and panicky. Occasionally, I glance in the mirror and see my own stricken face, and it's so not the face I want to see that I quickly look away again. I'm trying to keep the fear at bay by doing stuff. I've reorganized my hammock. I've redrafted my monthly budget to make it last 2 months. I'm doing a ton of walking because, you know, walking's free. Plus, it gives you endorphins and will therefore, in theory, cheer me up. Although I can't say that's really working. And I'm still up to date with Instagram. I've posted moody images of London streets at 4 a.m. I couldn't sleep, but I didn't mention that. I've posted a photo of the new pretzel stand at Victoria. I sound bright and breezy and employed. You'd never know the truth. Flora's been in touch quite a bit. She's left phone messages and texts and a long email starting,
oh, my God! I can't believe the witch fired you. That is so unfair.
I sent an email back, but I haven't spoken to her. I just feel too vulnerable right now. Sarah's also been in contact. In fact, she sent me a surprisingly long and sympathetic card. Apparently, Demeter got rid of Sarah's boyfriend, too, before I arrived at Cooper Clemo. He's called Jake, and he's a really good designer. Did nothing wrong, but got made redundant. He's still unemployed all these months later, and they're both fairly devastated, but trying to be positive. She ended with, I know how hard this is for you, and a string of sad faces. And you know, I'm sure she had the best of intentions or whatever, but it didn't altogether cheer me up. I never went to that drinks at the Blue Bear either. How could I? I'm not part of the gang anymore. And anyway, I couldn't afford to pay for my round. I'm hanging out a lot at home, but even that's stressful because of our new flatmate. Anita has sublet her room while she's away in Paris. It's totally against the rules, but our landlord never comes round. I wish he would. He might get rid of the way. Our new flatmate is a cheerful blonde girl called Irina, who has rosy cheeks and wears a floral headscarf a lot of the time. And I had great hopes of her until she invited all her friends round. I say friends. That's not exactly what it is. They're a religion. It's the Church of the Something. I didn't quite catch the name, and now I don't like to ask. And they all meet in her room and sing and have talks and shout, "Yes!" I have nothing against the Church of the Something. I'm sure they're very good people, only they're also quite noisy. So what with the singing and the way boxes and Alan yelling, "Knobhead!" at himself, it's getting quite oppressive in here. I've come into the kitchen to make my vegetable stew, and I'm crouching on the cardboard boxes, which are now so battered they keep half collapsing. Maybe I should join the Church of the Something. The thought crosses my mind, and I give a wry smile. Maybe that's the answer. Only I don't think I have the energy to shout, "Yes!" 20 times a night. I don't have much energy at all, is the truth. I feel drained. Defeated. I stir my butternut squash and rutabaga stew, cheap and nutritious, and close my eyes with tiredness. And just for a moment, with my guard down, I let my mind roam into places it shouldn't, places that are cold and scary and full of questions I don't want asked. What if I don't find a job? I will. But what if? There's a sudden dampness on my cheekbone. A tear is creeping out of one eye, I realize. It's the steam, I tell myself furiously. It's the onions. It's the way. "All right, Cat." Alan appears at the door of the kitchen, leaps up and starts doing chin-ups from the lintel. "Fine," I force a bright smile.
"Good."
I shake some dried herbs into my stew and give it a stir.
"Bunch of nutters, aren't they?"
He jerks his head toward Irina's room. "I think we should respect their beliefs," I say as another "Yes!" resounds through the flat.
"No,"
Alan bellows over his shoulder and grins at me. "Nutters. You know she wants another room for her friend. Asked if I'd move out. The nerve. They want to turn this place into a commune." "I'm sure they don't.
Do you reckon they shag or whatever?"
"What?"
"Like, they haven't all taken the pledge, have they?"
"I have no idea," I say frostily.
"I was just wondering." His eyes gleam. "A lot of these cults are into some crazy shit. Some of those girls are pretty hot."
He does a few more chin-ups, then adds,
"I mean, Irina's hot, come to that. Does she have someone?"
"I don't know." I scoop my stew into a bowl and say pointedly, "Excuse me." I clamber down off the weigh boxes and past Alan, heading back to my room. Please don't let Alan hook up with Irina, I'm thinking. I've heard Alan having sex, and it's like one of his motivational rants, but 10 times louder. I sit cross-legged on my bed, start forking stew into my mouth, and try to find something positive to think about. Come on, Katie. It's not all bad. I sent off a stack of applications today, so that's good. Maybe I should go onto Instagram now, post something fun. But as I scroll through the images on my phone, they seem to be mocking me. Who am I kidding with all this fake, happy stuff? I mean, who am I kidding exactly? Tears are running openly down my face now, as though they don't care who sees them. All my defenses are crumbling. There's only so long you can tell yourself that a crap situation is good and believe it. On impulse, I take a picture of my hammock, and then my rutabaga stew. It isn't like any Instagram images of stew I've ever seen. It's an unappealing pile of browny orange slop, like prison food. Imagine if I posted that on Instagram. The crappy truth. See my cut-price supper. Look at my tights falling out of their hammock. Look at all my job applications. God, I'm losing it now. I'm just tired, I tell myself firmly. Just tired. My phone suddenly rings and I jump, startled, nearly spilling my stew. And for a split second I think, a job? A job? A job! But it's Biddy. Of course it is. I haven't told Biddy or Dad about my job. Not yet. I mean, obviously I will tell them. I just don't know when. Okay, full disclosure. I'm hoping desperately that I won't ever have to tell them, ever. I'm hoping that I'll somehow be able to sort things out quietly for myself, get a new job, and tell them after the event in a light and easy way. Yes, I've changed jobs. It's no big deal. It was time to move on. Let them think it was my choice, a natural progression. Save them all that distress and worry. Save me all that distress and worry. Because if I tell Dad I've been let go from my job at Cooper Clemo... Oh, God. Just the thought makes me wince. I won't only be dealing with my own distress, I'll be dealing with his righteous anger, too. He'll rail and fume and ask me what went wrong. And right now, I don't feel strong enough for that. Biddy's different. More reasonable. But now isn't the moment to burden her. She's got enough on her plate with the glamping venture. I can already tell she's been overwhelmed. It's been more money and work than she expected, and it's consuming all her energy. I can't make her load heavier with my problems. Nor can I risk her offering me money, which I know she'd do like a shot. That's her inheritance, and it's going on the business, not on me. Honestly, I'd rather give up my flat in London than have Biddy subsidizing it. And I may get a new job tomorrow. I may. Hi, Biddy. I wipe my sleeve across my face. How are you? Biddy's been phoning me a lot ever since Christmas. It's actually been a real upside to this whole glamping thing. I'm talking to her so much more. I've helped her order furniture for the yurts, and we've discussed where to put every fire pit and bench. She's also had a lot of queries for Alan about the website, and to be fair to him, he's been super patient. In fact, between us, Alan and I are the total architects of this project. I'm not disturbing you, am I, darling? You're not eating? We've just been trying out a new lamb tagine recipe, actually. If we do offer dinners, I think it'll be quite good. Quite good. In the language of Biddy understatement, that means utterly delicious. I have a sudden image of her dolling out some fragrant marinated local lamb sprinkled with herbs from the garden, while Dad pours some of his cash and carry red wine. Great, I say. Well done. So, did you want to talk about menus? No, sorry, that wasn't it. Katie, the thing is... Biddy breaks off. She sounds nervous, I suddenly realize. Is everything okay? Yes, fine. Oh, love, Biddy seems tongue-tied. What? I demand. Biddy, what? Oh, Katie, she gulps. People have started booking. What? I know, she sounds dumbfounded. They're using the website. It's all working. I've taken 5 inquiries today alone. We've got 3 families booked in over the Easter weekend and 4 the week after. 4 families, Katie. Oh, my God. Even I feel quite shocked. I mean, I knew people would come in principle, but 4 families, all at once? Well, that's amazing. Biddy, you've done it. But we haven't, she wails. That's the point. Oh, darling, I'm petrified. We're going to have real customers, and I don't know how we're going to manage them, or entertain them, or... What if something goes wrong? And your dad's no help. I mean, he's a good man, but... She trails off, and I gape at the phone. I've never heard Biddy sound so rattled. You'll be great, I say reassuringly. I mean, you got your lovely breakfasts and all the activities. But how do we organize it all? I've asked Denise from the village to help out, but all she does is ask me questions I can't answer. Well, put her on to me. Or do you want me to come down at the weekend? Even as I say the words, I feel a sickening wrench. A return ticket to Somerset costs a fortune. How on earth can I afford that? But I've offered now. Oh, Katie, Biddy seems to dissolve. Would you? We rely on you so much, you know. When you're around, everything seems to fall into place. We'll pay your ticket, of course. And I know you're busy with your wonderful job in London, and we're ever so proud of you, but there was another thing. She hesitates, as though she can't bring herself to continue. What? There's silence down the line, and I wrinkle my brow in puzzlement. Just what can't Biddy bring herself to say? Biddy? Biddy, are you still there? Katie, you wouldn't have any holiday, would you? Says Biddy in a rush. You wouldn't be able to help us out, just at the start? Stay a week or two, maybe? Or as long as you can? Biddy, I begin automatically.
then break off. I don't know what I want to say. I didn't see this coming.
I know, Biddy instantly backtracks. I shouldn't ask. It's not fair. You're making your way in the world, and if you can't do it, we absolutely understand. You've got your career, your life, your flat. How's the redecoration going, by the way?
Oh, yes, it's fine. It's...
Ah! Oh, God! Ah!
With no warning, the world has turned black. For a terrifying instant, I think I'm being attacked. Something's hitting me, banging me, surrounding me. I flail with my arms, panting, panicking, then suddenly realize what's happened. My bloody hammock's collapsed. I fight my way out of a black jersey skirt, which has enveloped my head, and survey my bed in dismay. The hammock is hanging dismally from one corner. All my crap is everywhere. Clothes, hair products, books, magazines. It'll take forever to sort all this out again. The only plus is that my bowl of stew was on the floor and didn't get knocked over. Actually, that's not a plus.
Katie? Biddy's anxious voice is coming out of the phone. Katie? What's happened?
I grab the phone. I'm fine, sorry. Just knocked something over. I'm fine. I try to get my thoughts in order.
What were we saying?
I realized I never said, darling.
We'll pay you.
What? I say blankly. If you could come and help out, we'd pay you, of course. You know we've been wanting to pay you for everything you've done already, love. And now it looks like we'll have a budget.
I rub my face. You'd pay me.
It's a job offer. I've had a job offer. I almost want to laugh hysterically, but I don't. I stir my stew, fighting my own thoughts. An idea has crept into my head, an idea I can barely contemplate, because it feels like an idea of failure, of giving up, of everything collapsing into dust. I had so many dreams. I used to lie on my bed and study the tube map and imagine becoming one of those fast, confident people I'd seen on day trips to the capital. People in a hurry, with goals, aims, broad horizons. I'd imagined getting on a career ladder that could take me anywhere if I worked hard enough. Working on global brands, meeting fascinating people, living life to the max. And yes, I knew it would be hard, but maybe not this hard.
Katie?
Sorry, just thinking. It wouldn't be giving up, I tell myself sternly. It would just be...
What?
Regrouping. Because I can crack this. But maybe I need some time out first.
Biddy, hold on, I say abruptly. There's something I need to check.
I put down the phone, hurry out of my room, and knock on Irina's door. There's no response, but I push my way in anyway, telling myself that this is urgent, and Irina's God will understand. The room is a sea of bowed, silent heads. Shit. Obviously this is a moment of prayer or something, and now I've disturbed it. But I'm not backing away. I have to know. I tiptoe through the cross-legged figures until I reach Irina, who's sitting on the bed. Her blonde hair shining, her eyes closed, and her rosy face rapt. Alan's right, I find myself thinking. She is very hot.
Irina,
I whisper in her ear.
Irina, sorry to disturb, but is it true you want to sublet a room?
Irina's eyes pop open, and she turns to look at me.
Yes, she whispers back. It's for my friend, Sonia.
She gestures at Sonia, who is even more blonde and hot than Irina. Bloody hell, Alan's going to think he's gone to heaven.
Well, you can have mine.
Great, Irina's eyes widen.
When?
As soon as we can fix it up. Come and see me when you've finished. I tiptoe away again, thinking frantically, how exactly am I going to finesse this? I can't come clean to Biddy. She's in such a state right now. If she gets hassled by me and my problems too, then that won't help anybody. So, okay, here's what I'm going to do. 1, help Biddy and Dad. 2, not alarm them. 3, quietly sort out my life. 4, tell them the details on a need-to-know basis, preferably when everything is safely back on track again. 5, even when things are back on track, they will never need to know every painful detail of my life. 6, especially how Demeter couldn't even remember if she'd fired me or not. 7, or how I got mistaken for a homeless person. The only teeny problem is, what do I actually say? Right here, and now, what
do I say?
I pick up my phone and take a deep breath.
Biddy, there is a kind of, possibility, I say into the phone. It's hard to explain, kind of complicated. Anyway, the point is, I can help you. I'll come down tomorrow.
You'll come down?
Biddy sounds stunned.
Oh, Katie, love, how long can you stay for?
Not sure yet, I say vaguely. I need to talk to some people, make some arrangements. Probably a couple of weeks, or a few weeks. Something like that.
So, is it a sabbatical you're taking?
Biddy hazards.
Like that nice lady a couple of years ago who wanted to learn jam making, remember? On sabbatical from her job in the city. 6 months she had. Do you think you'll get that long?
I can hear the hope in Biddy's voice. To be honest, I'm not sure what to answer. 6 months. I have to find a job in 6 months. Surely.
I'll stay as long as I can, I say at last, dodging the question.
It'll be lovely to see you. I can't wait.
Oh, Katie, nor can I.
Biddy's joy bursts down the line in a torrent.
To have you at home again for a bit. Your dad will be thrilled. Everyone will be thrilled. Oh, love, I really think we can make this glamping into something with your help.
She talks on, and I lean back on my littered, lumpy bed, staring up at my stained ceiling. Her loving, enthusiastic voice is like balm on sore skin. Someone wants me. I'm already looking forward to home-cooked food, a room with an actual wardrobe, the view of the hills. But at the same time, my resolve is hardening like lacquer.
I'm taking time out, but I'm not giving up. I mean, I'm only in my 20s.
Am I going to let one setback crush my ambition? No. I'm still going to work in branding one day. I'm still going to stride over Waterloo Bridge and think, this is my city. It's going to happen.
Part 2. Chapter 12. 3 months later.
Right, I say into the phone. I understand. Thank you. I put the phone away and stare blankly ahead. Another headhunter with no joy. Another little lecture on how tricky the market is at the moment.
Still that pharmaceutical brand? Biddy's voice makes me jump, and I swivel round flustered.
I should have learned by now, never take calls from headhunters in the kitchen.
They do work you hard, love,
Biddy adds, dumping a bunch of beets on the counter.
I thought it was supposed to be your sabbatical.
Guilt is crawling through me, and I turn away, avoiding her gaze.
You start with one well-intentioned fib. Next thing, you've built up a whole fictitious life.
It all began a week after I'd gone home. A headhunter called me back right in front of Dad and Biddy. I had to think quickly on my feet, and the only story I could come up with was that Cooper Clemo were consulting me on a project. Now it's become my all-purpose excuse for taking calls and leaving the room. Whenever a headhunter calls me back, it's Cooper Clemo. And Dad and Biddy believe me implicitly. Why wouldn't they? They trust me. I should never have gone along with Biddy's version of events. But it was so easy, too easy. By the time I arrived in Somerset, she'd told Dad I was on sabbatical. And they both seemed to take it for granted. The thought of unpicking the story was just beyond me. So I didn't. Everyone believes I've taken a sabbatical, even Fee, because I couldn't risk telling her the truth and it ending up in some Facebook post which Biddy might stumble on. All Fee said was,
"Wow, UK employers are so generous."
Then she went straight into some story about going to the Hamptons and drinking pink margaritas. It was so much fun, and I have to come out. I didn't even know how to reply. Right now, my life could not be further from pink margaritas, or macchiatos, or cool pavement cafes in happening areas. When I go on Instagram these days, it's only to promote Anster's Farm. I told Fee about the glamping, and she asked a few mildly interested questions, but then she wanted to know,
"So, when will you be back in London?"
and,
"Don't you miss it?"
which touched a sore spot. "Of course I do." Then she started telling me about all the celebrities she'd spotted in some hotel bar that weekend. And I know she's still Fee. My mate Fee. Down-to-earth Fee. But it's getting harder to reconcile this glamorous New York Fee with the friend I could tell anything to. There's less and less about our lives that overlaps. Maybe I should go out to New York, forge our friendship again. But how can I afford to do that? Anyway, it's hardly my most pressing problem. There are jobs to be done. I'm about to help Biddy with the beats when my phone buzzes in my pocket with an email. It's from McWhirter Tong, the company I've just interviewed for. Oh, God. Casually, I open the kitchen door and step outside. The late May sun is warming the fields stretching ahead of me. A spire of smoke is rising from one of the campfires in the yurt village, and I can hear the distant chacking of jackdaws coming from a copse of ash trees in Northfield. Not that I'm really listening or admiring the scenery. I only care about this email because you never know. Please. As I jab at the screen, I feel sick with hope. I interviewed for them last week. I told Dad and Biddy I was seeing friends. It's the only interview I've had, the only crumb of hope I've been given, the only application I've made that's got anywhere. The offices were in Islington, and they were tiny, but the people were cool, and the work seemed really interesting, and, dear Cat, thanks so much for taking the time to visit us last week. It was good to chat, and we enjoyed meeting you, but unfortunately... Just for a moment, everything seems to go dark. Unfortunately. I let my phone fall down, blinking away the tears that have started to my eyes. Come on, Katie, pull it together. I take a few deep breaths and pace a little on the spot. It's one job, one rejection. So what? But a cold feeling is creeping over me. This was the only chance I had. No one else has even offered me an interview. Actually, that's not entirely true. When I started out, I had lots of emails offering me positions with stacks of potential or opportunities for development or valuable industry experience. It only took me about 3 phone calls to work out what those phrases mean. No money, no money, no money. I can't work for no money. However much experience it gives me, I'm past that stage. All right, Katie? Biddy's voice hails me and I whip round guiltily. She's depositing some peelings on the compost heap and eyes me with curiosity. What's up, love? Nothing, I say quickly. Just, you know, work stuff. I don't know how you do it, Biddy shakes her head. What with everything you do here, and all those emails you're always sending. Well, you know, I give a weird-sounding laugh. Keeps me busy. Biddy and Dad think that when I'm spending hours at the computer, I'm conversing with my London colleagues. Bouncing around ideas. Not desperately sending out application after application. I force myself to skim the rest of the email from McWhirter Tong. Incredibly strong field. Candidate with significantly more experience. Keep your name on file. Interest you in our intern scheme? The intern scheme. That's all they think I'm fit for. And I know the job market is competitive, and I know everyone finds it hard, but I can't help thinking... What did I do wrong? Was I crap at the interview? Am I crap full stop? And if so, what am I going to do? A big black chasm is opening up in my mind. A scary, dark hole. What if I can't find any paying job, ever? No. Stop. I mustn't think like that. I'll send off some more applications tonight. Widen the net. Oh, Katie, love. Biddy comes over. I meant to ask you. I had an inquiry earlier, and the lady asked about sustainability. What is it we say again? We talk about our solar panels, I say, glad of the distraction, and the outdoor shower, and the organic vegetables, and we don't mention Dad's jacuzzi. I'll write you out a crib sheet if you like. You're a star, Katie. Biddy pats my arm, then directs a reproving glance at my phone. Now don't let those London buses get to you, darling. You're on your sabbatical, remember? That's right, I smile wanly as she heads back into the kitchen, then sink onto the grass. I feel like I'm 2 people right now. I'm Kat, trying to make it in London, and I'm Katie, helping to run a glamping site. And it's fairly exhausting being both. On the plus side, the farm does look spectacular today. I'll go around later, take some photos and social media them. My eye is caught by the glinting solar panels on the shower barn, and I feel a twinge of pride. It was my idea to put in the solar panels.
We're not totally green at Anstor's farm. We use a supplementary boiler, and we do have proper loos. But we're not totally ungreen either. After only a few weeks of the season, I soon realised that some glampers are all about, are you sustainable, because that's really important to us. Whereas others are all about, are there proper hot showers, or am I going to die of cold? Because I was never that sure about glamping in the first place. It was Gavin's idea. So it's great to be able to reassure both camps. Everyone loves the shower barn, with its reclaimed school lockers and pegs, but they love our open-air roll-top bath even more. It's painted in rainbow stripes, inspired by a Paul Smith design, and has its own mini wicker fence enclosure, open to the sky. And it's just brilliant. I sent a photo of it to Alan to upload onto the website. It showed the rainbow bath with a bottle of champagne in an ice bucket and a cow looking over the wicker fence. And Alan sent back an email. Wow, V-cool. I mean, if even Alan appreciates it, it has to be good. The roll-top bath is so popular, we've had to instigate a rota. In fact, everything here is popular. I always thought Dad and Biddy would be able to make a go of this. What I didn't realise was how far they'd throw themselves into it, or how much effort they'd make. As for the yurts, they're beautiful. There are six of them in pairs. They're close enough that a couple could put their children in an adjoining one, but far enough away for privacy too. Each one sits on its own little deck and has its own fire pit. Dad knows a guy called Tim who works with wood and owed him a favour, so Tim put together six beds out of local reclaimed timber, and they're spectacular. They're on huge, exaggerated legs, and the headboards have Anstor's farm carved into them, and you can even separate them into two single beds for children. We have extra trundle beds too, because we found that lots of families like their children in with them, if they're young and the yurts are plenty big enough. The sheets are 400 thread count, we found a trade supplier, and the cushions are all vintage prints. Plus, each yurt has a sheepskin on the floor. Each family gets a little hamper of milk, tea, bread, plus homemade organic Anstor's Farm soap. Biddy looked around at local organic soap suppliers and then decided that she could easily do it herself. She makes it in tiny guest-sized cakes and scents it with rosemary and stamps AF on the front. And then, if guests want to, they can buy a big bar to take home, which usually they do. She also offers personalised soap with any initials on, which people can order as presents. That was all Biddy's idea. She's incredible. We've also invested in good Wi-Fi, not just good for the country, really good. It gets beamed straight to us from a mast 20 miles away. It costs a bit, and Dad was against it, but I know London people. They say they want to get away from it all, but when you tell them there's a Wi-Fi code, they nearly collapse in relief. And luckily, we have phone signal at the house, although not in the fields or the woods. If they want to call the office from the middle of a hike, too bad. Meanwhile, Dad's created a bike trail through the fields, and a mini-adventure playground, and a gypsy caravan where children can go and play if it rains. At night, we light lanterns along the paths of the yurt village, and it honestly looks like fairyland.
Farmer Mick!
I can hear excited shrieks coming from the path up to the woods.
Farmer Mick!
This is the biggest revelation of all. Dad. I thought Dad was going to be the problem. I thought he wasn't going to take it seriously. So I sat him down the week before the first guests arrived, and I said, "Listen, Dad, you have to be nice to the glampers. This is serious. It's Biddy's money. It's your future. Everything depends on your being charming and helping the glampers and making life easy for them. Okay? If they want to climb trees, help them climb trees. If they want to milk the cows, let them. And don't call them townies."
"I wouldn't," Dad replied defensively.
"Yes, you would. And be especially nice to the children," I added as a parting shot. Dad was very quiet for the rest of the day. At the time, I worried I'd offended him. But now I realise he was thinking. He was creating a role for himself. And just as Biddy has blown me away with her ideas, Dad's blown me away with basically turning into a completely different human being.
"Farmer Mick!" More tricks!
Dad appears round the corner of the shower barn, accompanied by the 3-year-old